Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from The New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week, we're going to be talking about Tom Hardy's BBC period drama Taboo and the Golden Globe winning movie musical La La Land.
Anna has also watched the 1984 TV adaptation of The Box of Delights for the first time, so she'll be telling us how that was later in the show. Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. We had a few emails and tweets, etc. I had a text from my mum saying that a few of you had difficulties getting the podcast delivered to your iTunes feed automatically last week. It should still be there in your feed. You might just have to download it manually. Do let us know if you had problems and we are looking into it.
Yeah, we are following it up. And if you do have problems, just, you know, take a screen grab on your phone and email it to us, and then that makes it much easier for us to chase up. Thank you. On to more exciting things. We had an amazing email from Hannah, who got in touch after we announced last week that Anna was going to be watching The Box of Delights. The subject of Hannah's email is just The Box of Delights! Exclamation mark, and then all caps, yay! Exclamation mark. She just got such love for the show. It was really nice to hear about it. She writes, "My parents bought it on VHS after my sister and I fell in love with the BBC's Narnia adaptations that came along a few years later. And as a 10-year-old, I loved and was absolutely terrified by it in equal measure. Although the composers for both shows were different, I can't help but hear the music for either and be instantly transported back to childhood winters." She would also really recommend reading The Midnight Folk and The Box of Delights, the novels by John Masefield. If you like Swallows and Amazons, which
you do,
I particularly do, it's not really the same, but the sense of children leading the adventure is what links them for me.
Oh, that's nice. It is quite an obscure programme, I think, so I'm not surprised that if you did love it, your delight would be extremely high on finding other people who did love it too. So thanks, Hannah, for that email. We also had an email from Erica, who recommends The Commitments, which has just gone onto American Netflix. I haven't actually checked to see if it's on UK Netflix, but we will investigate. Apparently it's a comedy drama musical directed by Alan Parker and an adaptation of Roddy Doyle novel. She also says, "P.S. thank you for saying what we're all feeling about Sherlock." I actually watched the next Sherlock episode over the weekend and I thought it was a great improvement.
Interesting, because we were only talking about the first episode of the new series. And although lots of you did get in touch to say how much you enjoyed our slating of Sherlock, you know, we like to take things seriously on this show. And obviously, if it's got better, we'll give it a chance. So I did not watch it on the basis that I found the first one really tedious, but maybe I should.
Well, this one is actually really built around a single mystery.
Ah, that is one of the big failings of the first one, I felt.
Exactly. So that has improved a lot, and it stars seriously favourite Toby Jones as this very, very gross, evil millionaire philanthropist who has a big thing of keys to a hospital that he's donated so much money to. He almost owns, remind you of anyone? And his favorite room is the morgue, remind you of anyone? And he's a criminal hiding in plain sight. So it's this weird sort of Jimmy Savile-esque idea, except this guy's a serial killer rather than a sort of sex crime monster. It's really dark, but I thought quite good. There's obviously a lot of standard Sherlock flourish and lots of silly extra plot lines going on as well.
Is there a ghost? Someone said on Twitter there was a ghost.
I don't remember there being a ghost.
The ghost of Mary. I saw people tweeting about the ghost of Mary.
Sorry. The hallucination that John is talking to at all times. Yeah, she's in it a lot. And there are other people who you're like, were they real? Were they not real? Mm. Yeah, mostly I just liked seeing Toby Jones absolutely go full evil creep. Everything about him suddenly looked really creepy to me, which is quite, you know, considering how much we love cuddly Toby Jones, yeah. It's quite impressive. So yeah, I did enjoy it.
So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is Taboo, which is an 8-part BBC drama series created by Stephen Knight, Tom Hardy, and Hardy's father, Edward. It stars Hardy Jr. as James Keziah Delaney, who returns to London in 1814 after being presumed dead for years, to find his father dead and the land he is due to inherit at the heart of a geopolitical battle between Britain, the United States, and the East India Company.
Yeah, I think that gets all the key words in there. Period. Geopolitical.
Yeah. Hardy. Many yeah. Hardys. Interesting trivia fact I found out when I was looking into this. So the third co-creator of this show, Stephen Knight, is also the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Ah.
And I think probably has made a tremendous fortune out of that. So anyway, apparently this is like the pet project of the Hardy boys, as I like to think of them, mm-hmm. Tom and his dad. And they've been working on it for absolute years, the story rather. And now finally it's been brought to the screen.
So I watched this, you watched this. Mm-hmm. I think you can tell it is a pet project for better and worse, if
yeah,
that makes sense.
True.
It's very weird and unusual, which is, I think, great. It's nice to see stuff that's a bit off the wall on, you know, primetime weekend BBC viewing, and I also think it's quite like varied in quality as a result. There are some scenes that I thought were really, really cool, and other times where I was just completely lost because there is a lot going on, and the level of detail and all these different plots can feel a little bit indulgent sometimes, a bit like another show we were talking about.
Yes, that's very true. I was also worried before I watched it that this show was going to be a lot of people like wading through mud as a mechanism to indicate ye olden days.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed it was. That is one of my pet hates about TV period drama, actually. Mm. That obviously there was bad sanitation in the days of yore, but that doesn't have to be like the main subject of a scene.
I also wonder, is it like a production trick to make these things like very, very badly lit? Is it a thing that people are going for purely in terms of atmosphere, where they're like, ooh, Victorian England, Dickensian, foggy, dark? Mm. Or is it like, oh, maybe if we make this scene a bit dark, you won't be able to see the like Fiat in the back of the shot. I don't know.
So yeah, it is quite muddy and grungy and bloody. It's quite dark. There's a lot of like people striking candles so you can just see their faces.
It's one of those shows also where I can imagine that there would be like articles on the Mirror being like, outrageous, no one can understand anything anyone's saying on BBC's Taboo. I had to use subtitles, said Deborah from yes. Sheepscombe.
Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah, and I felt very much that it was kind of two shows oddly yoked together, actually. There was one show in which Tom Hardy is a kind of zombie master returned from Africa to take over London, and he wades through a lot of mud, like looks at some horse guts, and like sees the undead everywhere. And then there's a different show in which Tom Hardy, the like wannabe entrepreneur, returns from Africa and disputes his inheritance in detail with the businessman of the East India Company.
Yeah.
And somehow these were both in the same program. I prefer the latter.
Yeah, I also find, are the racial politics of this show quite dubious?
Yeah, everyone keeps talking about Africa like it's one big place.
Yeah.
But although maybe that is how they thought of it at the time, I don't know.
And there's like some N-words thrown about in there in a way that I'm like, whoa, I don't know if I feel I mean, obviously it's period appropriate, but I'm still a bit like, is it really necessary?
There was that very, I thought, gratuitous bit where is Tom Hardy's character having a kind of hallucination where he sees all the dead bodies in the morgue like stand up, and one of them is this, I think it's meant to be a slave or look like a slave, and
I
it's just a bit
that.
Weird.
Yeah, a bit uncomfortable. And basically it's good for shows to sort of retrospectively explore racial politics, I think, but we were in a position where Tom Hardy basically becomes like black by association or African, you know, quotes, by association, and it's very strange because any sort of good work they do to be like, look how racist these people are, you're like, this guy is white, this doesn't make sense, he's like a British white person, and I'm a bit like confused as to why he becomes the symbol of like quote savagery and whatever. The fear is that it smacks of like a program that's like Daring with Race made by all white people.
Yeah,
and maybe that's not true, and the show might get really clever later on with that, but I don't know. For the moment, the jury's out for me. I spent a lot of the beginning of the program arguing with my boyfriend about who the woman was and whether she was Tom Hardy's sister. I thought she was the sister. He thought it was the ex-wife or maybe daughter. It was like...
It's half-sister. She says it later in the
she
program.
She does later. She like clarifies.
But there's this kind of hint that, you know, maybe relations between them have been not entirely fraternal, you know?
Yeah, maybe there's some incest going on there, which would be... taboo.
I know.
There's so many moments of this where you're like, is this the taboo? Like race, incest, money. Yeah. I don't know. It's like all very, I can just imagine people sat around discussing this like, yeah, but of course the real taboo at the heart of taboo is. Mixed feelings for me
mixed
overall.
Mixed feelings about it. One thing I did feel very positive about was the choice of locations. Mm-hmm. As someone who is very into like the outer Thames estuary, I really enjoyed all the scenes of Tom Hardy like walking along the foreshore. It's very actually a similar landscape to the Essex Serpent that we talked about before.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And I thought that was really nice to see that actually on screen. Lots of, you know, stuff about ships and docks. As I say, I was more interested in the kind of East India Company plot than I was the rest of it.
Yeah, starring everyone from Game of Thrones. Yeah, mixed thoughts, but I will keep watching to see if it starts getting really good.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Next, we're going to talk about La La Land, the second feature film from director Damien Chazelle. A musical in the old Hollywood style, it stars Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone as Seb and Mia, two struggling creatives in LA who fall in love and encourage each other to follow their dreams. That makes it sound like very, very twee and whimsical and not very cynical. But I think the great thing about this musical is it's kind of a mix of both those things.
Yeah, it's both starry-eyed, but also realistic at the same time somehow.
It's strange that we keep running into each other.
Maybe it means something.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I don't think so. You could just write your own roles, you know, write something that's as interesting as you are.
What are you gonna do?
I have my own club.
Is that gonna happen every time?
I think so.
How are you going to be a revolutionary if you're such a traditionalist? You're holding on to the past, but jazz is about the future.
Maybe I'm not
not good enough.
Yes, you are.
Maybe I'm not. It's like a pipe dream.
This is the dream. It's conflict and it's compromise. It's very, very exciting.
I've seen this a bunch of times. You saw it for the first time the other day. What were your immediate reactions?
I cried a lot.
The whole way through?
Basically, yeah. The film starts with this amazing set piece with loads of people in a traffic jam on a flyover in LA. And then the music begins and they start getting out of their cars and dancing on the roof. And the song is called Another Day of Sun. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of all about, we're all here in LA. It's the land of sun and opportunity. We get knocked back and we're just going to try harder this time.
Yeah, it's basically, I get knocked down.
Yeah.
But in the dreamy Hollywood stuff.
And it's just this like flowering of creativity out of the most boring quotidian thing, aka a traffic jam.
Mm-hmm.
And the point at which people started breakdancing, I just was like, lost it. I was like, this is so beautiful.
Caroline solved from the opening. Because I think that scene, they debated a lot about whether to keep it in or not, because basically it is so like immediately like, hello, you're in musical land. Yeah. Everyone here like sings and dances in unison when they're stuck in a traffic jam, that I think maybe the studio or some people thought maybe it was too much of a risk, so they took it out of certain screen tests. Mm. But people responded really well to it and they were like, oh yeah, we kind of have to keep this in. And I do think it's really good that it signals early on that this is a film that will just like launch into fantasy sometimes, because I think otherwise it might seem a bit more jarring when it does.
When it does later on, I think it's, yeah, you're right, it's good to establish early on that it does that. And it also works very well in the chronological framing narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually in that traffic jam is Seb and Mia's first encounter.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's rehearsing some lines and like forgets to inch her car forward slightly and he's behind her and he gets really annoyed and he like zooms around to overtake her and she gives him the finger.
There's a great line there as well that I think some of the best bits of this film are really low key, and there's a bit where Emma Stone, her character Mia, goes, what is his problem? Okay, I should go. Like that, 'cause she's like, no, I am holding up all the traffic. And those performances when they're, I just think they're so subtle, and just these little moments really can capture you.
As meet cutes go in movie history, giving someone the finger who honked at you in traffic,
mm-hmm,
is right up there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first of several like chance meetings that they have.
Yeah, and it's never actually specified whether they ever remember that one.
No.
They have several, as you say, meetings, and then they're sort of like, oh, I remember you. But I sort of like the idea that that's just for the audience and that they actually don't remember this.
They don't remember because, yeah. I mean, it's a split second. He might, mm-hmm, not even see her face properly, etc. So we follow Mia through the next few hours,
mm-hmm,
until she ends up in a piano bar where Seb is playing, and then it circles back to the traffic jam and we follow Seb back up to the same moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that meeting in the bar where Seb is contracted to play boring Christmas carols on a piano.
Some great comedy piano playing in, yeah, that scene.
And then he, you know, he just can't hold the jazz in.
Yeah.
And he starts playing his own compositions with great flourishes and stuff, and he gets fired. And Mia has heard him playing from outside and she's wandered in. And that is a kind of pivotal moment of the whole film. The whole thing revolves around it.
Mm-hmm. And that's when what they're calling on the score, Mia and Seb's theme, is first introduced, which is really, I think, the emotional heart of this film is actually this piece of music. And I think one of the reasons that I have like cried every time I've seen this movie, I've seen it four times now, is because the music is so moving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think obviously the performances are really good. I think especially Emma Stone's performance is just, yeah, like when you're looking at her face welling up with tears, it's really hard not to cry because she's just so good. And, you know, obviously the movie itself I find like an amazing feat of directing, but the music just anchors it and means that you can watch it again and again and again and still feel moved.
Yeah, we wanted to mention the Song Exploder podcast has done an episode about one particular song from this film.
Mm-hmm.
The song that's just called Mia's Audition, I think.
Yeah, it's just called Audition, I think, yeah. Brackets, The Fools Who Dream, yeah, close brackets.
Song Exploder, if you're not familiar with it, is a great podcast by Rishikesh Hirway in which he talks with a composer or a musician and gets them to take apart their song track by track, layer by layer, and then talk about why they made the creative decisions that they did. And so in this he's talking to the composer and the lyricists, mm-hmm, for this song.
It's Justin Hurwitz who's sort of overseen all the music.
Yeah, they just talk about why he orchestrated it the way he did, why particular instruments play what they do. Occasionally it lapses into what Hurwitz calls nerdy musical theory talk, but by and large it's just him saying, and then I wanted the violins to play this really high shimmery bit because it gives you this feeling of X, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what you understand from that is that he has thought about every single musical decision in terms of what emotion it will provoke.
He says at one point, I just think people feel like lots of different things in really quick succession, and it's not realistic to have like one emotion that's fairly flat throughout a whole song. It has to keep surprising you, which I think is so true.
Yeah, and it's brilliant that that's the way he's tried to construct his music. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're completely right in saying that it's the emotional heart of the film, and that's deliberate, and you know, someone's worked very hard to make it so.
We won't spoil this film too much, but I think the musical last 10 minutes of this film are just I've just not seen something in the movies like that ever before, and it's so emotional and it's so reliant on the music. There's no dialogue in the final sort of 10-minute scene of this film, and it's just beautiful. It's just I think it's an amazing feat. And there are some like problematic elements of this film for sure. I read a really good article by Ira Madison III on MTV about, you know, the idea of white jazz in this film bit, and the idea that basically white people are portrayed as the experts, or this one white character, Seb, is portrayed as the expert around jazz in a way that's like definitely racially problematic. But I still just instinctively respond so emotionally to this film. And for me, the Seb character and his plotline is actually probably the bit of the film I'm least interested in. But I just find their romance so moving, and the ideas behind it so moving. I love that there's so many scenes where they're watching things and having emotional reactions to them. We see so many scenes of Emma Stone watching Ryan Gosling play and having these emotional reactions, or maybe they're in a cinema or in a planetarium, or maybe watching their own home movies. You know, it's just these series of watching stuff play out in front of you and responding to it instinctively. And the idea that that doesn't have to be passive, I think, really moves me. And yeah, I just thought it was amazing.
We should just mention the look of the film. I found really attractive as well, because everything is like primary colours and bright, and there's a lot made of the sky. You know, there's a whole song about, isn't this a great sunset? What a shame that, you know, we're not a couple that's going to enjoy it. Hint hint, you will be soon. You know, that kind of thing. But there's also just this one shot after, without going into too much detail, Emma Stone's character is putting on this play and Ryan Gosling isn't there, and he like races in his car to go and see it, but the theatre's already been locked up. And there's this wide shot of him with his car parked in front of the theatre, with him standing in front kind of kicking at the curb in frustration, and everything is like dusky. I think it's even a lyric from one of the songs, dusky night and neon signs or something. And it's everything's kind of pink and purple, and I just thought, this is what everyone thinks LA is.
Yeah, it looks almost like a Hopper painting, some of those colours, and I love that. All those primary colours as well, I think, is where you can really start to see some of the influences from some older films. Like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg has been what so many critics keep saying is like the biggest influence on this film. And those, yeah, those really bright colours. There's even a moment where she points at the window from Casablanca, and underneath it's this shop, and they're selling those really, really primary yellow jackets, like from Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
And I think that Technicolor feel is just throughout this whole movie.
And then she, at some point, she wears a dress in that colour as well, I think, doesn't she? And they also, just in the way that the film is framed, you know, the beginning and the ending, before you see anything else, you see this big screen saying presented in CinemaScope. You know, it's also referential to the movie musicals. And I think in one of the interviews I've listened to with the director, or maybe it was even that Song Exploder episode, Justin Therwitz talks about how overcome he was at getting to record the music on the same soundstage that they recorded the scores for, like, Fred and Ginger musicals. And it's like, the people who made this are such Hollywood nerds.
Yeah.
And they are so happy to be, like, participating in this tradition.
Exactly. So I think it's a film that is designed for people who are nostalgic about Hollywood, and it'll probably win lots of... So already today, it's become the biggest Golden Globe winner ever. It's won more awards than anything. So I think, although the Golden Globes doesn't necessarily predict that well for the Oscars, I do think it will do amazingly well at the Oscars.
I think it was well. And I think what The Artist taught us about the Oscars, as, you know, many, many films had proved before, that Hollywood loves a film about Hollywood. You know, why do you think it's remade A Star Is Born like five times?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm pretty pleased, I have to say, that it will win big, even if it's for slightly cynical reasons, which is, you know, maybe a bit navel-gazing on the part of the Academy. But I love this film.
I really, really want the composer.
Yeah, Justin Hurwitz. We want him to win big. And I think Emma Stone as well.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be so bold as to say I have predictions for award season. I have hopes. Those are my hopes.
sun is nearly gone, the lights are turning on, a silver shine that stretches to the sea. We stumble on a view that's tailor-made for two. What a shame, those two are you and me. Some other girl and guy would love this swirling sky, but there's only you and I, and we've got no shot. This could never be, you're not the type for me, and there's not a spark inside. What a waste of a lovely night.
You say there's nothing here, well let's make something clear. I think I'll be the one to make that call.
But you'll call.
And though you looked so cute in your polyester suit,
it's wool.
You're right, I'd never fall for you at all.
Last time, I recommended that Anna give The Box of Delights, a 1984 BBC children's TV show, a go. Anna, what did you make of it?
Fucking weird.
It's so weird, isn't it?
It's so weird. Though I have to say, I think I watched the first episode, and I think that might just be setting the scene in terms of weirdness, was the vibe that I got, because it was more like a normal kid living his life with then like random interjections of weirdness. And I don't know what the rest of Box of Delights is like, but just from hearing you talk about it and Hannah's email, it seems like maybe it really ramps up as it goes along. I don't know.
It does. And as you might expect, you know, it being a story about a boy in the 1930s, it's based on a 1935 novel called The Box of Delights by John Masefield. You know, it's about this boy, Kay, who comes home from his boarding school and in the depths of winter to stay with his guardian, and he gets kind of brought into this pagan magic-y adventure.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like his life has been like dead normal before that, and this is like the transitionary episode. So
yes, exactly. So as he spends more and more time on the adventure, I guess you get more acclimatized to the fact that like horses fly and stuff.
Yeah. So in this first episode, everything's pretty normal. He's like getting on the train, and then there are these two guys in his compartment who are like so weird, like British.
Aren't they so creepy?
So creepy. And they're really like Queen's English British voices. And they're like, hello, young man. Like, wouldn't you like to play some cards? Oh, they do say that you should never play cards with strangers. Oh, but I suppose it wouldn't harm if I showed you how to play a trick. And they like know his name and everything. Mm. And then like when the train goes through certain tunnels, they seem to like have the heads of wolves. It's very, very odd. There's this like old guy who sort of like helped him get on the train, who's like hanging about and seems weird and magical, and he says that he's a showman, and he does a Punch and Judy show. And then Kay like tries to find him later, and this guy like shows him a phoenix in the flames. And it's all like really weird, basically. But yeah, I did find myself intrigued.
It is quite addictive, I found.
I think the atmosphere of it, perhaps more than actually what's happening.
It's very, like, the English version of pagan, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me a lot of, I don't know if you ever read the Susan Cooper books. You know,
I loved those, The Dark is Rising.
The Dark is Rising. All the stuff about Herne the Hunter and the symbolism of deer and stuff felt very similar to that.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is another, like, children resisting the rise of dark forces type book.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
So thanks. I would never have seen something like this if you hadn't recommended it to me, I don't think.
Well, I only got to watch it because my boyfriend vaguely remembered it from being on.
Mm.
And then he found you can buy the DVDs, and we watched the whole thing. And then we enjoyed it all before Christmas. And then actually on Christmas, one of his friends posted on Facebook, like, yay, happy Christmas. And he used a still from Box of Delights. And we were like, how do you know about this? No one knows about this. And then it prompted this whole conversation about it. And it turns out quite a lot of people
I guess if you're the right generation for it, you're the right generation for
Quite a lot of people like privately remember Box of Delights, but think that no one else does.
I think that I found this YouTube comment on the first episode that I just really spoke to that idea by someone called Alini, who put, "I watched this when I was very young at Christmas time in Greece more than 30 years ago. I'm 42 now, and it made quite an impression at me. I didn't know the name of this show as years flew by. The only thing I could still remember was the opening theme. It has haunted me. I came here by chance today without knowing what this was. And as soon as the opening theme played, I was a child again. ... I am not ashamed to say I cried." It's just the greatest like mini narrative. Also, I felt like I was reading a novel. And they put, "Thank you, Den Finch," who I believe is the uploader of this particular video, "for bringing back so many innocent memories." So yeah. Two great narratives that I enjoyed on the YouTube page for Box of Delights. So thanks very much.
So what are you going to recommend me for next time?
So for next time, I thought I'd go podcast. Mm. And a podcast that came to mind was Speed Dial, which is a podcast from Ira Madison III, who we mentioned earlier, and Doreen St. Felix, who are
two writers
that we both really enjoy, who both write for MTV. They're cultural critics, they're extremely sharp, and Speed Dial is their weekly podcast. They describe it as your weekly dive into all the pop culture news you should be following or leaving behind. And it has a series of like regular features, as well as interviews with guests like Kelly Rowland and JoJo. Ooh. So that's the level we're at. It's very good, and they have been getting more political since Trump, which I really enjoy as well.
Sounds great, look forward to it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, including in iTunes, where you could leave us a rating and a review. It helps other people find the show.
You can also get all our back episodes on seriouslypod.com, as well as details of how to sign up for our newsletter and what events we've got coming up.
Also on the website, you can find our specials on Home Alone, Gilmore Girls, Harry Potter, Love Actually, and Friends.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. We're SRSLYPOD on all of them.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.